the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your humble host is grateful to the listeners who subscribe and support this program. We have a new subscriber. Thank you, George Martin. Also, continuing supporters Gary Washington, Jeffrey Zeiser, and Kathleen Emmer. Sometimes you start feeling so lost and lonely. Then you find... In the second portion of this podcast, Norman Solomon returns, the longtime progressive activist. He nearly won a primary run for Congress here in California last year. And he recently criticized the Progressive Caucus in the House. We'll talk about that with Norman coming up in part two. But if there's any doubt, then I think I'll leave it out. Just tell me one thing, you can't get what you want. Do you know what you want? Since you can't get what you want. Our first guest today returns. He is Professor David Coates, the Worrell Chair in Anglo-American Studies at Wake Forest University. And he has just published an unintended third installment of what becomes a trilogy. His first installment was Answering Back, Liberal Responses to Conservative Arguments. Then it was followed by Making the Progressive Case. And his latest is called Pursuing the Progressive Case, followed by a question mark. And that, I think, is an important note. Professor, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Nice to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure, and I thank you for your new volume, and I want to encourage our listeners to find it and pick it up. They can always visit your website, David Coates, and I'm going to spell your last name, C-O-A-T-E-S, davidcoates.net. He also appears frequently at the Huffington Post with his commentaries. And, David, I want to begin, if it's not too schmaltzy here, by playing the bungled oath of office that was recited when Justice John Roberts screwed up about 4 years ago this week when the first Obama term commenced.
Take the oath, Senator.
I am.
I, Barack Hussein Obama,
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the office of President of the United States faithfully. And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Now, to prevent this, and also just because of the way the dates lined up, there will actually be a private swearing-in ceremony, followed by, on Martin Luther, the designated Martin Luther King holiday, the public inaugural ceremonies and inevitable corporate-sponsored balls, $50 million worth, that will follow that evening. But I want to focus on the oath of office. And ask you, David Coates, the extent to which you think the president lived up to that solemn oath.
Defend the Constitution of the United States, so help him God. Well, I think in many ways the first Obama term has been a disappointment. It's been a disappointment to many of the people who turned up that day, in their millions, if you remember, to actually celebrate the arrival of a Democratic president and the first African-American president. And the end of the George Bush era. for all sorts of reasons that probably we ought to talk about individually. We've experienced four years of underperformance. I mean, that's why there's a question mark in pursuing the progressive case, which, mm-hmm. as you know, is a collection of the blogs that were written as the thing developed. I mean, we were always struggling and fighting to push him in a particular direction. There are moments in the record when things were achieved that have been worthwhile. I do think the Affordable Care Act, in some of its details, has been a considerable achievement. But that, of course, too, did not live up to the hopes of many of us when this process began.
Mm-hmm.
And on so much of the agenda that was laid out, even in the first inaugural, which I have in front of me here, there's so much still to be done. So the question now for us, of course, is whether, with a renewed mandate, a slightly different, then there's some possibility that we'll get a better second term than the first.
Well, and David, not to be too literal, but I do take the statement in the oath of office quite literally. Mm. And I am very disappointed in the incursions on our constitutional rights, in the expansions of presidential power, the claimed authority to put people on a list for kill by drone strikes without due process. And your book is primarily about domestic political issues. But for me, first and foremost, the failings of the Obama administration and the great disappointment from expectations that I had, which I thought that I had properly tamped down, were that this former constitutional law instructor has bulldozed the Constitution in many significant ways. And to me, that is the long-term damage. My policy differences on the Affordable Care Act and on you know, even his failings in negotiations with the Republicans over the debt ceiling and their phony debt hawkishness that they found as the best way to oppose this president, I can live with those. I consider those relatively short-term. But the long-term damage to our Bill of Rights and the Fourth Amendment related to surveillance and search and seizure, the Fifth Amendment related to due process, I consider those to be the long-term damage that he either has acquiesced to or actively committed.
Well, I think I don't disagree with any of that, in truth. I just think that you can package that a different way and get even more worried, I think. I mean, what Barack Obama has not made any fundamental break with is with the imperial presidency, and indeed with America's imperial project. I mean, he came in, and what we liked so much about him was his refusal to support the Iraq war. But in fact, he gave us exactly what he promised he'd give us, which is he'd redirect that war into Afghanistan. Now, what made sense momentarily in 2001, but had long stopped making sense by the time we got to 2008, became the surge in Afghanistan from which we're now retreating. So, I mean, I get some small comfort, at least I'm watching, to see whether the arrival of these new people, Kerry and Hagel at the Pentagon and the State, do mark a determined effort by this administration in its second term to actually pull back from some of the more excessive features of that imperial presidency. But the appointment of the new head of the CIA, I mean, sends out a very strong signal that people who have actually been prepared to tolerate waterboarding and so on are still going to be key players in Washington. So I think one of the things we've got to push for as progressives is a fundamental rupture with the whole imperial project, which is not only undermining the United States globally, but actually, of course, as you say, is eroding rights at home and undermining the ability of the economy and society to correct some of the appalling problems with which we're having to deal.
And David, in your book, you basically reordered the blog posts that you wrote in real time over the last almost 4 years, up through November or December. And I wanted to ask you, as you look back at that body of work, and the reason I ask is because I've looked back at my podcasts, and I am shocked at the level of which I have been critical of a president whom I supported in 2008. And I never expected that I would become a lefty critic of the president who, you know, is certainly a relief from the neocon project of the Bush-Cheney administration. So as you review your commentary, what is your reaction along those lines?
Along those lines? Well, two reactions, Peter, actually. One is a great relief to discover, as I'm sure you do on your podcast, there's a high level of consistency. But as you say, a shifting sense of identification over time. I mean, early on, when the stimulus bill first came through, when the first moves on the foreclosure act, foreclosure crisis were there, when the first things were said about the bankers and the need to control them and so on, then there was a genuine sense that something very real was going to be achieved. But over time, that diminished. And it diminished partly, I think, because the political parameters around this president were much tighter than certainly I anticipated early on. In that first 2 years, he did not have a governing coalition. There were blue dog Democrats everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So even if he wanted to do things, it got extraordinarily difficult, very messy. Of course, after 2010, and partly because of that, all those blue dog Democrats were replaced by the true blue Republicans, and life became impossible. But also, and supplementarily, which is what we now got to think hard about, I think, he seemed to have a propensity to pursue those Republicans in a bipartisan way that involved abandoning principle time and time again. And he surrounded himself with highly conservative, particularly financial advisors, so that the first stimulus was far too small. It was far too much a giveaway to the Republicans in tax,
mm-hmm.
when in fact he could have done otherwise.
Indeed.
So with his wisdom of 2020 hindsight, he should have been more radical early on, and he should have actually chosen different people to work with. The fact that he didn't either tells you about his political naivete or it tells you about his political conservatism. And I think that's what we've now got to watch for. As he's learned and he's come through this process, is the process of being in government actually pulling him away to the right or slightly away to the left? And I think that's where the evidence that we've got before is at the minute is a bit uneven, to be honest.
Indeed. Now, I'm looking at the section called From Midterm Defeat to a Renewed Mandate, and this quote is from a post of February 7th, 2011. And you write, "For in the strategic vision apparently still prevalent in the current White House, the pursuit of bipartisanship remains fully in play. So too does the associated belief that the crucial center ground of American electoral politics can be won back, not by the clear magnetic pull of well-articulated liberal refutations of Tea Party nonsense, but by the endless and ultimately fruitless pursuit of bipartisan agreement on individual policy details. Tacking to the right in pursuit of the center may seem the statesmanlike thing to do. It may seem presidential rather than partisan, but it is ultimately self-defeating for the politics of the center-left." And I think that is a defining statement about this president, who still, by appointing a Republican, Chuck Hagel, to defense, and I reluctantly support him mainly because of the people who oppose him,
yes.
And because he's occasionally had lucent moments where he blurted out the truth. It wasn't PC to call it the Jewish lobby, but his comment about the Israeli lobby resonates with me. The Jack Lew appointment to Treasury is more of the same, protecting Wall Street. His failure, and we'll put aside the failure to pursue war crimes, but the failure to actively pursue the criminal behavior that nearly took our economy over a real cliff in 2008, to me, is obstruction of justice and, to some extent, criminal in itself.
Yes. I mean, I think when we look back over this two-term president, unless things fundamentally change, that will be the dominant impression that's left behind, that he wasn't strong enough on Wall Street, that, in fact, on the contrary, his people were far too close and they let people get away literally with financial murder. And they should not have done that. They should be much tougher. And that his foreign policy continued and doubled down really on the very things about George Bush's foreign policy that he was in some sense elected to reverse. I watch now a slightly different presidential style, and you must have seen this too. This second election has clearly given him a sense of self-confidence. He isn't just there because nobody liked George W. Bush. He seems to be there because people prefer him distinctly to the person he was running against. he's now saying rather firmer terms. He did a superb job, I think, in relation to the gun issue when he went to Newtown. He's now saying things in relation to gun control and in relation to immigration reform that he should have been saying long before. But on these core economic and foreign policy issues, the issue there is whether there'll be any fundamental change. I suspect there will be less than you and I would both think as a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, in addition, will he now start a campaign to win back the House in November 2014? Because if he does, then there's a chance of a liberal progressive agenda being his swan song and setting up another administration. If he doesn't, then we'll just have four more years of gridlock. And at some point, I assume, Republicans will just come back in because people get so fed up with politicians talking at each other and doing nothing.
Critical point. We see this, we saw it played out in 96 when Clinton sailed to re-election over Bob Dole, but failed to lift a finger to elect a Congress who could support, a muscular agenda, and he ended up doing all these bite-sized things in his second term. And likewise, Obama raised $1 billion, while the media fudged the polls to make it look like it was going to be close, Nate Silver knew what the real numbers were, and, it turned out to be a wide margin victory for the president, but he did not campaign to support even moderate Democrats to try to turn the House. And so now he lives with the Boehner problem for at least two more years. And I don't understand that. You refer at one point to the indiscipline of the left. And I think that plays out in a number of ways, because here the president, and I do agree, I remain somewhat pessimistic that we'll get any significant new gun regulation through the Congress.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I applaud him for finally taking a grip on this issue and offering some leadership. And this is where we do have to acknowledge the weakness even of those he has in the Senate majority. Over this past weekend, Harry Reid gave an interview on television in Nevada where he played down the assault weapons ban. And it's one of the few things I agree with my Senator Dianne Feinstein on. And it's early on in this process. And instead of providing leadership and at least a front that this is worth doing, Harry Reid is out there saying maybe he could get it through the Senate, but it can't get through the House, so why bother? And he shifted the conversation to immigration reform.
Yeah.
And repeatedly on the management of even the innocent people detained at Guantanamo, much less those who have been charged and could have been tried in the United States, Obama and his administration attempted certain things and then retreated in the face of opposition, not just from the Republicans who were sworn to destroy President Obama, but to Democrats who undermined him on those critical issues.
Yeah. Well, I think the thought that came to mind, Peter, as you were saying that, was, I'm not sure whether this will work for everybody, but there was a Harry Reid equivalent in the United Kingdom in the general strike of 1926, a man called J.H. Thomas. He was completely hopeless. And
Say his name again?
J.H. Thomas.
Okay.
And he was completely hopeless. And I think it was Bertrand Russell said, you know, if all that capitalism faces is J.H. Thomas, it'll last forever, you know. And I think that's true that Harry Reid's not at all an impressive character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that tells you something about the quality of the political class. I mean, our basic problem here is, with certain noticeable exceptions, the quality of these people is very poor. But there are certain things that we can still say, I think, that might give us some chance of progress between now and 2016. I mean, one is that part of the reason that Obama won was the quality of the ground game. And running up to the election itself, in fact, I just wasn't reading Nate Silver carefully enough, I was pretty convinced it was going to be very close. So for a long time, many of us, perhaps not you, but certainly I, was holding back my criticism because I didn't want to do anything that would let Romney and that crew in. There was no one was making the defensive case for Obama because of the danger that the neocons would come back and we'd have a nuclear war with Iran and so on. Now, that's gone now, and so I think we've got to say very clearly that the kind of ground game that was organized to get him into return into the White House has now got to be refocused to take out Tea Party Republicans at the state level, even though they used the 2010 power to gerrymander themselves into positions where it's very, very difficult to do that. So we won't be able to get to, even if we put the ground game into full play, it won't be possible to win it unless he's also at the front. I'm putting the liberal case so strongly that we pull the electorate back towards liberal positions long and discredit the Republicans long before November 2014 comes in. If he thinks he can bipartisan his way to genuine deals with these people, then we're doomed. But if, in fact, on the contrary, he continually forces the Republicans to demonstrate that it's their negativity that's actually blocking a decent jobs bill, it's their negativity that's intensifying poverty by blocking rising increases in the minimum wage and so on. If he can do that, it won't turn him into a very progressive president, but it might give us a chance to get a very progressive House. And once we've got a progressive House again, then maybe we can do something at the federal level.
To the first part of that comment, I do not posture as holier than thou, but as I explained to my listeners, David, I had the luxury here in California of casting a protest vote. And because of the constitutional issues that I raised at the outset, I chose not to vote for a second term for President Obama and instead supported Rocky Anderson as a write-in vote, the New Justice Party. And still, I make no judgment of people who, felt, particularly in battleground states, that they only had two choices. And I understand the way our process works. And I would add to that that I am pleased to see that MSNBC has recovered from its election year role as MSDNC, and that in particular Rachel Maddow is now free to criticize the Obama administration on critical issues.
Yeah.
That was clearly absent, and I was offended by that during the election cycle. I want to turn to your section on stimulus and deficits. And in this phony fiscal cliff melodrama that played out at the end of 2012, having vilified Harry Reid, I do want to praise him, because while it's a deal that sucked and they buried the issue of the failure to renew the payroll tax cut holiday or the payroll tax holiday, so that average workers actually took a higher percentage tax increase and felt it immediately over the uber wealthy who came off relatively well in the process. Harry Reid stopped the president from a giveaway on Social Security.
Yeah.
And as you point out in this section, and so many others, Robert Reich, the recent Sunday Times editorial, this is such a dangerous situation where, starting in the 2011 debt ceiling challenge that was concocted by the Republicans, the president threw Social Security and Medicare on the table. And these insurance programs have the unfortunate label of entitlements, which is a budget term that is not, it has been twisted the way liberal has into a far different meaning. But for the president to offer a reformulation of the COLA that provides for increases for Social Security recipients is really criminal and would not do a damn thing to address the long-term borrowing balance of the United States.
No, you're absolutely right. And I mean, in this mixture of signals in the wind about whether we're going to get a more progressive stance or slightly more progressive stance, I mean, that's one of the huge negatives, I think. What the hell was he doing that for? I mean, even if he bought the argument, which is, as you say, a false argument, that Social Security should be in the mix anyway, I mean, removing the payroll to the cap and actually pushing the payroll tax right up to the very highest earners,
mm-hmm.
would have been a more progressive way of handling it.
We could even throw a donut hole in there, David, from $110,000 to $250,000, so the president could have preserved his pledge not to raise taxes
on. There's so many things he could have done that he didn't do. Now, either he's so busy and he's not concentrating, or he's genuinely gone off the ranch. And I think, you know, we've just got to find out which is the case. I mean, as I understand it, but we're all reading the same stuff, and I don't know these people directly at all. Jack Lew made a fierce defense of Medicaid and Medicare inside those negotiations, so that we at least seem to have an incoming Treasury Secretary, if he gets there, who doesn't automatically think Wall Street, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And these small details, though they don't, of course, transform the world, they matter enormously to hard-pressed American workers and retirees. So, I mean, the notion that a Democratic president should use his negotiating capacity to actually cut the living standards of the poorer sections of the old is really intolerable, I think.
David, I want to turn to your closing comments in your new book, which is called Pursuing the Progressive Case? And it's entitled Final Thoughts, Obama at Halftime. And you refer to the Affordable Care Act and the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and its Consumer Protection Agency, or Act. And then you describe them as woefully incomplete. You go on. We have yet to see a comprehensive immigration reform. Now, they do seem to be addressing that. We have yet to see a serious assault on mass unemployment or generalized poverty. That's not even on the agenda.
No.
We have yet to see any successful resolution of the home foreclosure crisis. Oh, modest efforts to assist people, but this most recent settlement amounts to an insulting couple of thousand dollars to people who've already lost their homes. You go on. American troops remain at war in Afghanistan. Well, he's responding to public opinion and accelerating his timeline for our withdrawal, and I'll give him points for that. The fatuous idea that the Afghan forces are ready to stand on their own is as laughable as the Vietnamization program that I recall vividly under President Nixon. And you go on. The American welfare state remains under threat, and the grand promise of effective climate change legislation is all but forgotten. If campaigning is poetry and governing is prose, Obama the candidate has proved thus far more adept at the poetry than the prose, and the question has to be asked, why?
Do you want me to say what I answer that as? I mean,
please.
Two answers, aren't there? One is, well, he was never very progressive. He never intended to be progressive, so it's a false question to ask. You didn't expect these things of him. The other is to say that, in fact, he inherited these very difficult conditions with a weak governing coalition and a propensity for bipartisanship, so that he weakened himself. And I think that explains a large part of the underperformance from a progressive point of view in the first term of his office. And I think, actually, probably all of us are guilty of giving him too much slack, because, you know, we assume that, in fact, his instincts were good, but he was surrounded by people whose instincts were not. Now, I think now we have to watch, see who he puts in place, see what he actually says. His inaugural will be quite important. The State of the Union and the budget will be vital, I think. He's already put in place huge cuts in $2.4 trillion worth of spending cuts are already committed by this president under the pressure of the Republicans. There must be no more.
And on the next page, you write, for there was more, not just externally dictated limits on what a left-leaning president might do, but also internally adopted constraints on what a president chose to do. And you know, I saw two flashes of fire from Obama in the speech where he introduced his jobs bill in the fall of 2011.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was annoying to hear that speech because he kept saying, you know, send me that bill and I'll sign it. But he really showed a defiance of the Republican cabal that had obstructed virtually every meaningful effort on his part. And then during the campaign, after the failed first debate, he came alive, and in some of his stump speeches, he properly laid the blame for our domestic financial problems on his predecessor. He never quite could put the Bush word, and personalize it, which I think would have helped. But in those two phases, he showed a kind of a feisty leadership and a willingness to plunge forward despite the obvious barricades that were thrown up in his face.
Well, you also had two other speeches that were being given in points. I mean, one was the one where you went down into Kansas to celebrate Teddy Roosevelt's 100th anniversary, when he articulated very clearly this notion of fairness, and that then inspired the campaign's argument that the rich should pay their fair share. What he wouldn't do was to go the extra inch, which is so vital, which is to argue that power and reward should be shared more equally in industry and in commerce. So, in fact, he remained, as it were, trapped on the terrain of consumption and taxation, which is where the Republicans and center-right Democrats always like to be. We don't talk about production in this country enough. We don't talk about workers enough, even though we're all workers. We don't talk about class, and we don't talk about trade unions. But then he went and challenged, after he was elected, didn't he, the right-to-work legislation that was then passing through, forgive me, with the state, the northeastern states slipped away. So he occasionally got these flashes that he realizes that he's got to actually strengthen progressive institutions. He's got to push a set of progressive principles around which people can cohere. I mean, the beginning and end of this, Peter, is we need a genuine New Deal, one that strengthens the rights of Americans as workers as well as consumers, that raises their living standards by getting decent wages back into the system, and we have to do that. We have to pull American manufacturing back from overseas. That is a huge economic and social project. It can't be done in the space of one term, but it could be set up beautifully if he would take that on now that he's worried about his legacy, and use it as a base to get rid of Tea Party Republicans in 2014 and then go forward. When I put these kind of arguments out to my more radical friends, they say it's just a fantasy. Well, it's not a fantasy, it's a goal. And I think those of us who are on the left have got to use every opportunity we can to press the president to do that and the public dialogue to move in that direction. And occasionally you see flashes in this man where he's able to do at least some part of that. He wasn't, and that's what makes me feel it's the pressure is still worth keeping on him, because he has the national focus, he has the bully pulpit, he hasn't got another election to face. Now let's see him use it properly.
And David, I appreciate your optimism. I don't describe it as pie in the sky, and I see it as a palliative to some of the more depressing thoughts that I have. And here you offer a clear narrative. He needs to make a sharp and distinct break from the conservative narrative now dominant in Washington, the narrative that says that success in America is always the product of small government, low taxes, and unregulated private enterprise. He needs both to make that break and to educate the American electorate on the importance of it. The Republicans may have lost the White House in 2012, but make no mistake, they still command the framing of the American political mind. This is so important. You go on. Ronald Reagan still figures too highly and too regularly in the Washington Beltway's American pantheon. And at some point you describe it, oh, here it is. Obama needs to make a full and fundamental break with the whole Reagan project and hagiography. Amen, brother.
Well, that's you converted and me converted. Now we've got to get on and convert him, I think, yeah.
Well,
that's political leadership on the left that we need, yes.
There's another important point you make somewhere in the book, and that is that people too often, just focus on the president and that he should fix everything, and that we invest too much energy in, liking Obama or not liking Obama. And, you know, one of the things we have to look at is progressives ourselves. And our intermittent attention and devotion to these issues, because the right comes suited up in full football regalia with pads and helmets, ready to knock out our quarterback every day. And they play defense in the minority much better than we ever did. They play offense when they even when they don't have the majority, better than the left ever has. And we have to reflect on our own roles and the way we're often content to sit back with that remote control and say, well, you know, somebody else has to do this for me.
Yes, and I think the thing that makes it even darker in a way is the task the Republicans set themselves is easier than the task that progressives set, that we set. All they've got to do is block and make government not work, and then they turn around and say government doesn't work, see, so you don't need it, you know, and then they can get on with running the private market and taking all the surpluses to themselves and leave everybody else stranded. We're saying we need sophisticated government that rearranges the rules under which people live so that real freedom and not just negative freedom is what people experience, because they're empowered to make real decisions. They have the resources, the wages, the money, and so on, and the education to be able to design the life that they want. We are, in that sense, the great advocates of freedom, but we need a strong state to create the rules and the capacity for people to realize that. And it's a much more difficult job we have than they have. And as you say, they're very well funded. They understand the importance of ideological struggle. They know how important ideas and framings are.
Indeed.
And we don't do anything enough of that, which is what, you know, you try and do on your program, what I try and do with my writing, just be one of the voices out there trying to redress the balance to some degree.
David Coates, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. What is the best way for people to acquire your new book, Pursuing the Progressive Case?
It's a Kindle freak. You can go to Amazon.com and buy it for, I think it's $3.99, something
okay.
Wonderfully small.
Mm-hmm.
And then you read in bed because it'll send you to sleep wonderfully quickly. You know? But Amazon's the best place. And it's just a chance to consolidate our grasp on what happened on the first term before we start trying to get a better second term. And thank you so much for talking to me about it.
And once again, your website is David Coates, C-O-A-T-E-S, davidcoates.net. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much, Peter. You take care.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, taking a look back at Obama's first term and previewing the second term. Norman Solomon joins me next here on the PBC podcast.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within.
Can you pin?
Smiling faces sometimes they don't tell the
truth. You may be listening to this podcast on the official Martin Luther King holiday, which is the public inauguration of Barack Obama for his second term. And we continue with our look back at the first 4 years and the prospects for the next 4 years. And I'm pleased that Norman Solomon is returning to our program today. A man of many credits, he's a founder of the Institute for Public Accuracy, which tries to get progressive speakers and thoughts into the corporate media. He also is a co-founder of Roots Action. We'll talk a little bit about that. Progressive Democrats of America. He is the author of War Made Easy, and it was just last week that I recommended that to a Facebook friend who needs a little help with some of that history. And he also ran for Congress in my district here in California last year, coming within, 173 votes of making the runoff into the general election. Norman, welcome back to the PBC show.
Hey, thanks, Peter.
Great to talk with you, and there's a lot to talk about. I wanted to ask you, as I did Professor Coates in our first segment, to listen to the history from 4 years ago as John Roberts, the Chief Justice, mangled the recitation of the presidential oath of office.
Take the oath, Senator.
I am.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the office of President of the United States faithfully. And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
So, Norman, beyond the failure to get it right, I want to ask you, has Barack Obama preserved, protected, and defended the Constitution of the United States, in your opinion?
Well, if you get beyond what is called real politic and the so-called art of the possible, I have to say no. That the Bill of Rights is supposed to be not 10 amendments minus half of an amendment when convenient. It's supposed to be there in full. And when we have now the second administration in a row, for instance, throwing habeas corpus under the bus, then you have a problem, and we have a problem. So on those grounds alone, I think we have reasons for not only deep concern, but mobilizing opposition to the attacks on civil liberties.
Well, and I focus on the partial nullification and what I consider to be the realistic rollbacks in the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. And let's start with the Fourth. That says, in very simple English, there are no dangling participles or predicatory clauses. It says that, no search or seizure will take place without probable cause and a court order. And we just saw with the leadership, in air quotes, of California Senator Dianne Feinstein, the renewal with zero amendments of the FISA law, which Barack Obama said he would oppose in 2008 and then voted for in August of that year. And this permits the dragnet monitoring of Americans' communications. They say that it's for catching foreigners who communicate with people in the United States. But we know that the diversion of our telecommunications traffic is done on a massive scale, and the NSA has just is building, I don't think it's completed yet, this huge data center in Utah, where presumably they are storing those communications. We also saw that through administrative action, the length of time that these purloined conversations or communications can be held was extended, and this is on innocent people, okay, people who have not been charged with anything. It used to be that they had to be destroyed after 6 months, and through an administrative practice, the Obama administration has extended that to 5 years.
Well, by coincidence, that's, I think, the length of the extension, is it not, of the FISA and so forth?
You are correct.
And we have, I think, in retrospect, sometimes a clarity, because we are able to see what turned out to foreshadow what. As you mentioned, as the nominee of the Democratic Party in 2008, he shocked some of his supporters, and I was certainly unhappy about it, when he voted against the civil liberties position on the floor of the Senate in terms of FISA. And I have a little anecdote there, Peter, which may, again, in retrospect, be emblematic. I was elected as an Obama delegate to the 2008 Democratic National Convention, and in the state of California, we had on a going basis some phone conference calls with all of the Obama delegates from the state. And I remember after that, we had one of those calls, and I wanted to bring up and tried to bring up the FISA vote that Obama had cast.
Mm-hmm.
And it was shunted aside, and then later we got the minutes of the phone call that said it had been discussed. So with no discussion, in retrospect, the official record said it had been. And this, in 1,001 ways, unfortunately, was prefigurative and reflective of a sort of a mode of operation. And so
let me swap a story there, because you and I were together in Denver, you a delegate, and I was doing my syndicated radio show from the convention. And I recall vividly interviewing Michael Yockey. And Michael, I've known for many years. He was Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. He was a supervisor on the San Francisco board, and he was running the platform committee. And I said, Michael, I'm very concerned about this shift on FISA. And coincidentally, the big sponsor of the convention was AT&T. And he said, well, we've taken that issue off the table so that it can't be used against us. And I said, Michael, you don't take my Fourth Amendment off the table for the convenience of an election. And if you stood firm on it, you would attract more votes than you lose. And he just kind of smiled at me in a condescending way with a verbal pat on my bald head and said, oh, well, we're taking it off the table.
Mm.
And I thought that was really telling, because, as we know, in the Pelosi parlance, unfortunately, when something is taken off the table, it usually doesn't come back. And I'm thinking of impeachment proceedings back in the Bush-Cheney era.
Well, if we look at the last 4 years as on the verge of the second term, President Obama is gearing up all sorts of initiatives again. This is a paradigm. And I'm really interested in behavior. You know, some people, pro or con, I think, get into the psychological conjecture. As a journalist, and often I think it is or should be similar to a scientist, we need to deal with data. We need to deal with empirical activity and behavior. And we don't know what Obama believes, and frankly, in the light of history, it won't much matter. It's what he does and the contrast with what he says. And what we have seen continually is that although he has done what I think are some good progressive things around gay rights and so forth,
mm-hmm.
on the whole, he has had a very corporatist and military-oriented approach to foreign policy and certainly corporate priorities, domestic policy. You know, I was speaking recently with a reporter. I said, well, you know, we hoped for kind of a Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the modern era for the 21st century, and we got a Dwight Eisenhower. And so the implications of that, I think, have been very chilling towards civil liberties, we use the word chilling, but also in terms of turning the page. And it turned out that in so many ways, after 8 years of the Bush administration, with so much of a war on terror, quote-unquote, umbrella over so much unnecessary war and civil liberties abrogation and so forth, we've had continuity. And if I were to sort of underscore one aspect having to do particularly with foreign policy that has been so negative and destructive, it's that the Obama administration has made the so-called war on terror bipartisan. And in parallel with making the undercutting of civil liberties bipartisan, it has made perpetual war also a bipartisanship sort of a flag to wave. And I think that's where we are in the beginning of 2013.
I want to turn next to the Fifth Amendment, and in particular, the use of a drone in Yemen to kill, to summarily execute, Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen and an associate of his, and in a separate attack a week later. Awlaki's 16-year-old son, an American citizen who was born in Colorado. And to his credit, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon recently sent a letter to John Brennan, who's been managing the drone program at the White House. Of course, he spent 25 years at the CIA, was the deputy director during the period when the rendition, detention, and torture programs and the development of the drone programs were all coming out of the agency. And now Obama has nominated him to run the CIA. And this issue of the Fifth Amendment, again, is very clear, that one's life and liberty may not be taken without due process. And we've heard Eric Holder rationalize that there was a process, but we don't know the basis for it, the legal framework. They say there is one. And Obama, in nominating Brennan, said that, you know, this is the guy who's built a legal framework around this targeted killing program. Yet we are not permitted to see that. And I refer to it as the new John Yoo. We don't know who it is, presumably in the Justice Department, who authored a memo. And a federal court judge in New York issued a ruling saying that, you know, in her own estimation, it was sad that she could not order the release of the document. And this is a pretty close quote. She said, it's not lost on me. The Alice in Wonderland nature of my ruling is not lost on me. And so here we have rolled up a very critical element of the Fifth Amendment, and the courts say we can't go there.
When I was growing up, and call me old-fashioned because I believed in it then and now, one of the distinguishing characteristics of our democracy from a dictatorship or having a king was that the head of the government couldn't say, I want Joan Jones or Jane Smith or Barry Wilson killed. Here's his name. Go out and kill him. I mean, we are supposed to have a country where the president can't do that, even though he's the most powerful official of the government. And due process is absolutely at the core of this constitutional democratic concept. When we have due process turned into simply a rhetorical phrase, then we're dealing with the consequences that we have now. I think it was John Stewart said that, well, it sounds like due process is just something that we do. And that doesn't do it in terms of civil liberties. There was a writer online, Amy Davidson, as I recall, who wrote about a year ago that due process has been twisted and turned into a presidential concept that it's due process if the president thinks about it. Well, that should not be acceptable.
Well, and it defies the constitutional structure of checks and balances such as they were, because all of this is taking place within the administrative branch. And that, you know, is not consistent with the Constitution. Norman, I want to turn next to your expertise on America's war machine and ask you first about the exit from Iraq. Because while during the campaign the president could narrowly say, I took us out of Iraq, we know that there were machinations right down to the wire to execute a status of forces agreement that would have permitted a much greater remainder force. And also, most Americans aren't aware of this, but there is now a small force back in Iraq that is positioning for a possible involvement in the war in Syria. And so, number one, can Obama say that he kept his promise to get us out of Iraq? And number two, are we really?
Well, I think we could say in retrospect, you know, he kept his promise, but his fingers were crossed. And the option to continue to intervene in the region and to have some sort of presence in Iraq, you know, has been retained. If I think Bush and Obama had had their ways, there would not have been a withdrawal to the extent there was of military boots on the ground. But the liability question came up, that being politicians and having to be somewhat responsive to their own population, the leaders of the Iraqi government didn't want American troops to be able to, with impunity, kill Iraqis and not have to answer to Iraqi law or courts or whatever, as flawed as they may be. And so just as a political necessity, I suppose, or at least perception as such, President felt, well, you know, we can't stay there on that basis. This puppet has lost too many strings in terms of the leadership of the Iraqi government. Mm-hmm. So, in a way, some real credit must be given to WikiLeaks. And if the government allegations and his own lawyer statements are to be believed, Bradley Manning
good point.
Deserves so much praise and credit for setting out enough information in the public sphere that the White House felt compelled to say, look, we've been exposed. The impunity killings of Iraqis that the U.S. military didn't have to face anything but its own version of justice in response to, we can't stay there. And I think it goes to a larger point. Perpetual war, which we are in now, we're into close to a dozen years of it, does thrive on secrecy, on spin, and on lack of transparency. All that should be antithetical to a democracy.
Now, Norman, to Afghanistan, where, again, going back to our experience at the convention in Denver, during the stadium speech is where Obama inserted that he's going to get us out of Iraq. And I'm paraphrasing, but he was going to complete the task in Afghanistan. He then rolled over by keeping Robert Gates, the Republican, as defense secretary. He acceded to the generals for two troop escalations, one that was called a surge, based on the myth of the surge success in Iraq. And only now that he's safely reelected, did he bring Mr. Karzai to Washington to announce that he is accelerating America's withdrawal based on the phony notion that the Afghans are ready to take over? And only after Karzai returned to Kabul where you have visited, by the way, did we learn that the deal was greased with the gift of a fleet of drones that the United States is going to deliver to the Afghans. And I think that that is a mistake on many fronts, the drone part. But first, if you would, speak to the issue of the escalation and now at least the media meme that we are hastening our exit from Afghanistan.
Well, in real time, like a lot of people, I've tried to prevent this tragedy of strategy over the last 4 years. Almost exactly 4 years ago, well, in December of 2008, with President-elect Obama putting together his cabinet, I was on C-SPAN's Washington Journal Live, in which I pleaded with the president and with the leadership in Congress not to escalate the war in Afghanistan. But since since the swearing-in of President Obama 4 years ago, the troop levels were tripled up to 100,000 of uniformed troops, an equal number of ununiformed contractors, and it was a disaster from the get-go. For what? We have more troops in Afghanistan now than were there when Obama became president. There was all this rhetorical capital devoted to how important it was to send those troops. So many more Afghan people dead, a lot more Americans dead and wounded physically and psychologically. What was the point of all that? I went in the summer of 2009, as you mentioned, to Kabul, and I came back and wrote a report for a couple of members of Congress, and I said, and this is a quote, "The wheels are coming off U.S. policy in Afghanistan as the escalation and sending of more troops was continuing." Now, I'm not all that bright a person in terms of geopolitical military strategy. I went, I listened, I looked, and it was clear to me that this policy was heading towards greater and greater disaster. Now we are in the beginning of 2013, and Peter, maybe you can tell me, what was it all for?
Well, it was for nothing. We have made no gains, and you know, we now have Stanley McChrystal on a book tour and personal rehabilitation campaign, and he's trying to rationalize the moves that he made where, you know, we're going to, you know, build a presence in Kandahar and in some of these towns. And we have not held any of them, not that that is a worthy goal to begin with. But the idea that there has been a conversion to Afghan ability to control its own future is a big lie. And, you know, we heard it from Karzai and from Obama in their news conference in mid-January, as they told us with straight faces that the, and here's the phrase, that the abilities of the Afghan army are exceeding initial expectations. Now, I've had zero expectations, so if expectations are notched up to 1%, I guess that is exceeding those initial expectations. But, you know, Karzai can't even maintain control of the capital and his corrupt clubhouse, much less take on the array of forces that are termed in the media just the Taliban. But you've got the Haqqani network. You have a whole range of insurgent groups and warlords there. And the idea now that we're going to give them drones, and we're told they're not manned, they're not armed, they're surveillance drones, but nonetheless, the idea that Karzai can hold on to power after we leave, and he's saying that he personally will be exiting, so we have no idea what the successor government would be. We know that they don't have a fair election process. And so my sense is that at some point the warlords and or the Taliban will be back in control, and we're going to gift them drone technology, which they could sell to the highest bidder. And I just think that this is a very irresponsible move, and it's all based on the mythical foundation that we have Afghanized this war in the way Nixon and Kissinger claimed we had Vietnamized that war.
Well, a lot of the dynamic that makes that kind of irresponsibility and deception possible is, of course, the mass media, corporate-owned, backed, underwritten, and so forth. And Stanley McChrystal's book tour, and I think you characterized it quite correctly, can be especially successful to the large extent that it is abetted and sucked up to by the mainstream reporters. General McChrystal, just in the last couple of days, appeared on the PBS NewsHour, interviewed, as I remember, by Margaret Warner, and like most of the people who are the mainstream journalists there, just absolutely was an accessory to his spin machine as he puffed himself up, puffed up the so-called surge and all the implications of that. I think you're quite correct, Peter, to remind us about the Vietnam War experience, because as the U.S. troops were withdrawn from Vietnam, the U.S. bombing actually increased. As a matter of fact, if you looked at the half-million troop-level reduction between mid-1969 and mid-1972, during the same time that the troop levels were drastically decreased, there was actually more bombing of that country than in the previous 5 years. So this is a pattern, and the drone, which are, in the case of U.S. attacks, of course, often manned and or unmanned, but often are shooting at people and killing them, that's part of it. That from a U.S. political standpoint, and Obama is part of this cast of approach, yes, it's unpopular to have so many U.S. troops there, so get them out of there and get fewer and fewer of them remaining, but ratchet up the killing from the air. That is the formula. It's the formula that took place in Vietnam. It's the formula today in Afghanistan.
Norman, I want to turn to the progressive community, such as it is in the United States, and the people who we hope are representing us in Congress. And you wrote a powerful essay recently that was widely circulated on the web, where you offered a very friendly critique of the House Progressive Caucus. And you noted that repeatedly they will take positions that really sound good and that stake out our values, and ultimately they cave when it's time to line up and be good Democrats and support the White House or the minority leader. Talk a little bit about the caucus and its wobbly nature over the last couple of years.
Well, it is the largest caucus of Democrats in the Congress, and there are now 72 members of the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives, all of them Democrats the last time I checked. And it includes some wonderful people, including a very good leadership team now of Raul Grijalva and Keith Ellison as co-chairs. And yet, the closer the members of the Progressive Caucus get to a historic high-stakes vote on the floor, the fewer votes it musters to actually oppose some of the most egregious corporate-oriented, rip-off the middle class and poor policies that the Obama administration has been moving into, splitting the difference often with Republicans, and then the Republicans don't move, and splitting the difference again and again. And so we can go back to the healthcare vote that was in early 2009 and the abdication of responsibility, the co-chairs at that point of Progressive Caucus having publicly promised in the fall of 2009, and I should say the vote was in early 2010.
Yeah.
So the promise publicly was, hey, we are going to refuse to vote for any health care bill without a robust, and that was their word, robust public option, and not a single member of the Progressive Caucus ended up voting for any bill with any robust or any public option at all. In fact, everybody in the caucus voted for a health care bill with no public option at all. And, you know, Peter, I'm not an English professor, but I don't even think any academic could make a case that no public option can be understood to be a robust public option. But this has been a paradigm, and so we've seen it again and again, most recently.
Well, let me just stop for a second on the health care vote, because I think it's a critical one. And I was reminded recently by a friend who's even leftier than me That it was one of the final critical votes that was pulled in by the White House was our friend Dennis Kucinich, who, by the way, just signed on as a commentator at Fox News. And I'll withhold judgment to see if he becomes a fiery voice for us from the Fox News pulpit. He'll certainly not cave in the way Alan Colmes used to do, but I'm not sure about that move. At any rate, Kucinich was he ended up having a conference with the president on Air Force One, and that was when he delivered his vote. And as I look back now, I say, well, Dennis, shouldn't you have at least gotten some election protection for yourself? Because he got gerrymandered into a new district by Republicans and then was defeated by a corporate Democrat, and the White House didn't lift a finger to help Dennis Kucinich in that battle.
Well, certainly it's plausible that the White House is very glad to see Kucinich go. It's a huge loss for progressives in the Congress. It was, you know, a tough situation, and I think another course would have been to say, I will not vote if my vote clearly will be the defeating vote for this health care bill, because the health care bill was, you know, arguable about is it better to have it or not. But as he said, it was a lousy bill. And unfortunately, that too was a paradigm where it sort of fed a sense of cynicism that nobody in Congress can or should really stand up for principle and keep standing.
And Norman, I interrupted you there. I think you were about to talk about the recent fiscal cliff melodrama and the way Democrats fell in line with a very dangerous move from the president and the White House to put Social Security formulas for benefit increases on the chopping block in a way that we all know rationally has no connection to either the current budget deficit, the $1 trillion that we're running, or the long-term government debt.
Yeah, to allow any sort of discussion in practical political terms of the so-called chained CPI, the cost of living adjustment, to allow any discussion of the possibility of reducing that into a discourse on the deficit is absurd, since, as you're noting, Social Security adds not a penny to the deficit. And yet, the Obama administration has done that quite ominously in saying it would be willing to reduce cost of living allowance for Social Security. And we're looking at that coming up as early as, say, late February or into March, when the deficit ceiling vote will be coming to raise the deficit ceiling. And that's going to be a bargaining chip for the Republicans. And Obama's already said he's willing to go there. What happened on New Year's Day this year was, again, part of the pattern, the closing act of yet another scripted drama out of the White House, where basically Obama has just said repeatedly in recent years, I must insist that the Bush tax cuts for those above $250,000 a year income must not be renewed. Those tax cuts must end. And you know, if there's something that he was most adamant about last year, I can't remember anything more adamant from Obama than saying that. So then he's raised it to $400,000 for individuals, $450,000 for a couple. And so people in the Progressive Caucus were left with this choice. At that point, there were 75 members, the last vote, really, of the last session. What do we do? As it turned out, this basically bad deal was approved by a 44-vote margin. There were 75 members of that caucus, and only 7 of them voted against the bad deal.
And Norman, going forward, my concern is that Mitch McConnell will prevail in his argument that, okay, you got your tax increase, that's it. And yeah, the amount of revenue generated by it is minuscule. It doesn't address the near-term, you know, annual budget deficit or do anything to pay down the long-term debt. And so the next phase is all going to be arguments around cuts. And as we know, the Defense Department and the intelligence community and Homeland Security, those are sacrosanct. We've got everybody feared up so that you cannot even discuss meaningful cuts in those budgets, which are the ones that have expanded exponentially over the last 10 years. And instead, they're going to turn to the so-called entitlements, which, again, don't have any effect on the current year deficits that we're running. And then they're going to whack it out of what remains of the 12% of, what is it, discretionary non-defense spending.
Well, this is what I was alluding to in the piece where I said that every time now, based on the record, when leadership or members of the Progressive Caucus say, we're going to stand firm if we need to against the White House, that you can hear the laughter from the West Wing, because it's clear that time and again, with very few exceptions, this largest caucus of Democrats, the Progressive Caucus, in the end allows itself to be rolled by the White House. That has to change, and I think that's really the takeaway on this aspect of our discussion, I think, Peter, that wherever listeners to this podcast are living, if you have a progressive or semi-progressive member of the Congress who is supposed to be representing you, the chances are he or she has caved repeatedly to President Obama when he or she should not have done that. And with Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid at risk now in the next few weeks and beyond, it's imperative that we demand of these folks in the Progressive Caucus and elsewhere in the Congress, it's not good enough to talk good, to introduce good bills. You got to talk the talk and walk the walk. That includes on the floor of the House of Representatives.
And Norman, you're a tireless activist, and I want to acknowledge to my listeners I've been remiss in discussing Roots Action. But this is an important new progressive activist group that was formed, what, about 18 months ago?
That's right.
And people like Jeff Cohen, David Swanson, and you are really working hard to coalesce those of us who care about these issues. So take a moment here to talk about Roots Action, and let's recruit some new activists to the cause.
Yes, well, anybody can sign up to receive rootsaction.org activist alerts and things you can do very easily and quickly by going to our site, which is rootsaction.org. We're an action arm, and so this organization was born out of the realization that progressives have a lot of great informational resources on the web, websites and podcasts and so forth, giving so much insight and information, but we're relatively poor in terms of action arms that can take action quickly and decisively. And whether it's anti-war or fighting the corporate power and many other issues, defending civil liberties, RootsAction.org is really distinctive because we're willing to put up a fight. And so we now have more than almost a quarter million, I'll put it that way. We're well over, at this point, 210,000 people who are active currently, who are getting our list emails as of today and taking action. And if you want to become one of them, please do go to RootsAction.org, sign up. And it is a dynamic, ongoing activism arm that we expect will continue to grow in the weeks and months ahead.
Norman, before we wrap up here, is there anything that I didn't bring up or you didn't get a chance to talk about that you'd like to at least raise with our listeners?
Well, I'd underscore that there's a tremendous tendency in our political culture, and it often does pop up on the left, to personalize critiques or defenses of the President of the United States, particularly one who is personally so, well, affable and admirable as Barack Obama. It's important not to do that when we're talking about policy. It's a big mistake to say, oh, he's a wonderful man, and so I'm just going to assume he's trying to do all this good stuff that I believe in. It's also a mistake to say, oh, I think he's a terrible liar, vicious, deceitful individual, so I'm going to argue it on that basis. Rather than go either of those routes, I urge people to say, let's go ahead and deal with the actions. Let's do political analysis, not psychoanalysis. And when we look at the policies, with no danger of Barack Obama being defeated for re-election. That's all past. It is time to build strong, principled opposition to this presidency.
Norman, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I appreciate your knowledge and also your real sense of involvement and activism. And I feel a little bit inspired after talking with you today.
Well, thanks so much, Peter. And as always, I admire the work you're doing. Keep on keeping on.
Norman Solomon here on the Peter B. Collins Show. 4 more years. Are you ready? Are you fired up? Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.